If there's no lawmaker, there can't be any law. Therefore, if there's no God, there couldn't be any natural law. So the lawful design that we find both in nature outside us and in our own moral nature is a very strong argument for the existence of God. Because you can't have a law without a lawmaker, divine or human. Genesis 1 and Exodus 20 are two of the most important chapters in the Bible because Genesis 1 shows the order of nature, and Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, shows the order of morality. And since the law and the lawmaker go together, Dostoevsky's famous saying, "If God does not exist, everything is permissible," is another powerful argument for the existence of God. It's the moral argument. If there's no God, if there's nothing higher than my reason and will, I'm the only lawmaker. And if I want to change the law, if I want to say that hate is good and love is evil, or not everybody is equal, this race is inferior and it's good to hate them, who's to say that I'm wrong except you, and you're no better than me? So then it comes down to power. If God does not exist, everything is permissible. Obviously not everything is permissible, therefore there must be a God above us. That's perhaps the strongest of all arguments for the existence of God, because in order to refute it, you've got to not take morality seriously. You've got to say, morality is just my invention. It's like the rules of a game. And if I want to play baseball for only 8 innings instead of 9, nobody's telling me that I'm wrong because I made the rules. That's a horrible conclusion. All right, so law is terribly important. What does law do to freedom? My next to last point, how do you relate law and freedom? Well, on the one hand, law restricts freedom. You can't do some things. You can't kill each other. You can't steal. You can't do this. You may not do this. You can do it. You may have the power to do it, but you can't do it without being punished. So law restricts freedom. Too much freedom is not good. Secondly, law directs freedom. It appeals to freedom. Please freely choose with your free will to do good rather than evil. Finally, law perfects freedom. The more you obey natural laws, the better off you are. The more you obey the laws of your physical body, the healthier you will be. And the more you obey the laws of morality, the more morally healthy and happy you will be, and freed from addiction. I think one of the reasons The Lord of the Rings is the most popular book of the 20th century, by all the polls, is that deep down we know that here is a book that teaches us that we are sinners. That word is very unpopular in modern society, but that ring of infinite, unlimited power that everybody's addicted to, even good people, that's a great image for sin. It's the power of addiction. It takes away your freedom. And law perfects your freedom, your liberty. And therefore, there should be no contrast between law and freedom. There shouldn't be a contrast between law and order people and freedom people, as in most people's minds there is. You know, conservatives are for law and order and liberals are for freedom. And the right wants law and order and the left wants freedom. You can't have either one without the other. And finally, the relation between truth and freedom. The truth makes you free. Wait a minute, doesn't truth restrict your freedom? I know more about the truth of the economics of the United States of America than I know about the truth of the economics of, let's say, Nicaragua. Never been to Nicaragua, all right? So I'm free to think what I want about Nicaragua, right? But not America. So I'm less free with regard to economics in America? No, just the opposite. Since I know nothing about economics in Nicaragua, if I went there, I could never get rich. I don't even know if they have a capitalist economy. In America, I might. It's always the truth that makes you free. If I don't know much about war or love or sports or the opera, if I don't know the truth, I can't be a good lover or a good warrior or a good sports hero or a good opera singer. I have to know the truth, and I have to know the law, and I have to practice according to the law, and then I'm free. I'm not free to play what I want on the piano if I haven't disciplined myself by law, and if I don't understand and know scales and chords and the rest of it. So truth and law on the one hand, and freedom on the other hand, they're allies, not enemies. All right, final point. Where does God come in? And where does our ultimate happiness with God come in to all of this? Well, the general answer is pretty obvious. Everything that God created, he created for our happiness, for our ultimate true beatitude. Everything is a Jacob's ladder connecting us to God. And those angels going up and down that ladder, they're everything. God made the universe as a cathedral for us to worship in. And he made our bodies as temples for us to worship in. And he made our minds as roadmaps to travel to him in, because he's pure love. There's only two persons that you can never, ever avoid for 1 second in time or in eternity, yourself and God. And everything else is relative to those two. That's why I love the Jacob's ladder image. Here's Jacob at the bottom of the ladder. Here's God at the top. Everything else is on that ladder, including all the things I talked about tonight. So how do we put them in a kind of roadmap? All right, start with God, the Alpha, the beginning, the creator. He knows everything. So truth exists in his mind, and by his ordering divine providence, he makes a world and a life for us, a ladder for us to come back up to him. He comes down to us so we can go back up to him. That's the plot of every story. Home, away from home, back home again. In God's home. And when that design, when that truth, when that divine providence applies itself to good and evil, to morality, it becomes moral law. Law is truth about goodness. And what law appeals to is our free choice to obey it or to disobey it. So it presupposes free will. And insofar as we obey it, we develop virtue, habits of goodness. And insofar as we develop virtue, we develop true liberty, freedom from addiction to sin. And insofar as we do that, we are not hindered on our road to God, who is our supreme good and our supreme happiness. So you can picture the entire universe as a kind of a cosmic circulatory system. God pumps the blood of being through creation of a universe. They're the veins. Wait a minute, I always get veins and arteries backwards. Arteries pump the blood out, right? And veins suck it back in? Or is it verse 3? Whichever. By truth, and that truth becomes law, and that law appeals to our freedom, and that freedom makes us enables us to choose virtue, and that virtue gives us liberty, and that liberty gives us the supreme good, happiness, which is God as our ultimate end. So he's the beginning and the end. Well, that's a beautiful scheme, but I haven't talked that much about evil and how that scheme is messed up by us. Of course, you can fill in the blanks very easily. For every good, there's an evil, which is simply the denial of good. Evil's not a separate thing. Evil's simply the perversion of good. Evil can only exist in a thing that's good, and all things are good because God made them. Even mosquitoes, even hemorrhoids, everything is good in itself. That takes an act of faith, but you got to believe it. But the scheme seems to have been messed up by original sin. And by all the actual sins that came from it. So what did God do about it? Well, the rescue operation. And Jesus didn't just come to preach morality, although he did that. He didn't come just to perfect morality by living a perfect human life. He did that. And he didn't come even just to save us from sin, although he certainly did that. He came to make everything new. That's almost the last thing he says in the Bible. And Mel Gibson, I think, was an absolute genius in inserting that great line into that incredible movie, The Passion of the Christ, in the mouth of Mary, in the mouth of Jesus, talking to Mary, his mother, as on the Via Dolorosa, she is in agony watching him die in stages, and they're amazed that he's still alive after all that torture, and he's carrying this cross, and he's hugging it like a teddy bear. You can see that he's active. He's not a victim. She doesn't understand that. Why do you have to do this, she says. And he turns to her and he says, see, Mother, I make all things new. That's my candidate for the greatest line in the history of cinema. That's what Jesus does. He makes all things new. He straightens everything out. Well, I can't top that. That's my last thing to say. Now comes the interesting part. I thank you for being so patient through your purgatory. Now your heaven begins. Well, if not heaven, at least something close to it. Q&A. Since I have ADD, I almost always get bored listening to monologues, even if they're good talks. But I'm never bored of the dialogue and Q&A. So I think of a speech as simply a preparatory dialogue, like the diving board is to a swimming pool. So now, finally, we can get off the diving board and into the swimming pool. Someone pass around a mic for you to ask me questions. And I hope I've confused you but interested you enough so that you'll have many questions about. Could you be a little clearer about this?
Okay, so we'll take some questions at this time.
Which is the greatest of the cardinal virtues?
No question, charity. It's what God is. The Bible says God is just, God is wise, and never says God is justice, God is wisdom, it does say God is love. Love is the giving of the self to another self. Love is very mysterious. Love is not a feeling, although it's helped by feelings. Love is not even simply a choice, although it certainly is that. Love is the gift of yourself and your life and your time and your everything to another person. Somehow you can give yourself away, and only if you give yourself away do you find yourself. And but every religion in the world knows something of that secret. Isn't that amazing? Even if they don't know who does it, even if they don't know Christ, they know that the secret of human happiness is unselfish love.
Among prudence, courage, temperance, and justice, which is the greatest?
Prudence. Everything's based on that. If you don't see the truth, you can't do anything else. The world's best surgeon with the world's best instrument in the world's best hospital cannot perform the simplest operation if the lights go out. It's not enough, but it's the necessary beginning. And by the way, it has very little to do with IQ. Sometimes the least educated people are the most wise. We have a saying in academia, that idea is so insane, only a PhD could possibly believe it.
If pride is the root of so much sin, why do you think humility isn't one of the four cardinal virtues?
Well, when St. Augustine was asked to list the four cardinal virtues, he replied, humility, 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 and humility. Humility doesn't mean having a low opinion of yourself. And pride doesn't mean simply having too high an opinion of yourself. That's just vanity. That's a sin, but it's a minor sin. Pride is essentially competitive, playing God. My will be done. And humility is letting God be God. Humility is what Muslims call Islam, total surrender and submission to the perfect will of the perfect God. At its heart, Islam is a profoundly right religion. At its periphery, it's done a lot of bad things. But that's a beautiful and profound idea. That's it. That's the essence of all true religion.
Please excuse the devil's advocate, but your argument about without God, the law of nature couldn't exist. Couldn't they say that it's just power, the power of the claw versus power of the hoof?
Sure, you're absolutely right. If there's no God behind the moral law, then what's behind the moral law is the power of those who make it, and that's not divine power, it's human power. So whoever's got the power to make the law can define justice and can define good and evil. That's right. That's exactly the philosophy of fascism. Under Hitler, who created a new law, it is good to have a Holocaust. And it is bad to believe in equal rights or democracy or anything like that. Yeah, right. That's exactly the point of the argument. It's called a reduction to absurdity argument. You refute an idea by showing that it necessarily produces an absurd conclusion.
You mentioned how in Revelation that the church is the bride.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I run across a lot of people, and when I ask them, you know, or invite them to church, they say, oh, I don't need church because I pray to God and I love God, and that's sufficient for me. And so I'm just wondering if you have any pearls of wisdom as a response to those comments.
Well, it's a very easy response to that. Just as you are both a body and a soul, you are both visible and invisible, so the church, which is God's design for us, is both visible and invisible. The church is a visible institution. It's organized religion. Jesus invented organized religion. On the other hand, the church is also the people of God, the mystical body of Christ, and nobody but God knows exactly who's in it. So it's both. And the genius of Catholic theology is that on almost every controversial issue, it says both and rather than either or. It doesn't, like the Pharisees, satisfy itself with external, visible, legal obedience. And it doesn't, like the Gnostics, say, oh, I don't need any of that. I'm a pure spirit. I can just worship God all alone. That's pride.
Thank you.
By the way, to say organized religion doesn't necessarily mean nice, clean, neat religion. One of the Bible's images of the church is Noah's Ark. And I don't think that was too organized. Think of all the animal poop. And there's a lot of poop in the church. Even popes poop.
It's hard to follow that. Okay, best living Thomist to read and best dead Thomist to read.
Wait a minute, the best living what?
Thomist. Thomism.
Thomist?
Yeah.
Oh.
Thank you.
Best dead Thomist is Thomas Aquinas. But that's a little unfair. My candidate for the best dead Thomist is one of the wisest men I ever met. He was my teacher at Fordham University, Father Norris Clark, S.J., and he was utterly honest and humble and saintly, and like Thomas Aquinas, he thought on his feet, and just absolutely loved the truth. I recommend a little book of his called Person and Being. It's kind of philosophical and kind of abstract, but I think it's terribly important. He says that Thomas is the greatest theologian of all time, the greatest philosopher of all time with regard to objective truth and the nature of reality and everything outside the human person. And then he says that the greatest thing that exists in the whole universe as a human person, and he doesn't develop that. And modern philosophers tend to develop that in non-theistic directions. Yeah, I'm a person and I'm a little God. And he says, let's take the best from both. Let's take the objective truth from Aquinas and let's take the subjective truth from good modern philosophers and psychologists and have a Thomistic personalism, which I think is the wave of the future. That's the essential presupposition of John Paul II's philosophy. That's what made him, I think, one of the best philosophers of the 20th century. I don't know any great living Thomists. There are good ones. Gilson and Maritain are probably the two greatest 20th century Thomists.
I think Chesterton asked this question once. What is wrong with the world?
The London Times asked a number of writers to reply to that question. And his answer was two words. I am. Sincerely yours, G.K. Chesterton. Deep down, we all know that's true. How come the world's such a mess? Look in the mirror. What can I do about it? Look in the mirror. Sit on the toilet.
Well, I know you're a baseball fan, so is the Cubs winning the World Series a sign of the end times, or what are your thoughts on that?
You mean you think you're still living on Earth? You didn't see what happened in the 10th inning? The sky rolled apart, and a voice that sounded like Charlton Heston said, "Now, those of you who are wise know that this doesn't happen on Earth. You're all in heaven." I pity the poor Cubs fans. Now they're ordinary. They're normal. They're like secularized Jews. They've lost their distinctive identity. They were the Jews of baseball, God's chosen people, chosen to suffer. Now who are they? You know, we had an 86-year-old curse in Boston, and now we're used to success. We've won three World Series since 2004, so we're normal. So who are we? We've got an identity crisis. It's a good identity crisis, though. God bless them. By the way, is Steve Bartman out of hiding? He was in the witness protection program for a while. We had a ceremony at Fenway Park a couple of years ago, a Forgive Billy Buckner ceremony. So I hope the Cubs fans do that to Steve.
I'm intrigued by what you had to say about the relationship between happiness and poverty. And I was wondering if you have read Father Thomas Dubé's Happy Are You Poor?
What's the title?
Happy Are You Poor, I believe.
No, I will. I love Father Thomas Dubé. His book, The Fire Within, is the best book I have ever read about mysticism. It explains St. John of the Cross. In fact, the first Catholic book I ever read, I was about 16 years old, had no idea what it meant. I was just bored, got it in a bookstore, and I said, wow, this is a mountain. As an evangelical Protestant, I had never read any of the Catholic saints, and you know, I basically knew what it is to be a saint, but this was fantastic. But I never quite understood him, but I was fascinated with him. Then I read Thomas Dubé, and it's all clear. He's a great writer. I will read that book. This is one of the things I love about Pope Francis, by the way. Like St. Francis, he knows by experience how to be happy.
I'm sure you've
I just
seen
wish he wouldn't have such loose lips on airplanes, but that's okay.
I'm sure you've seen in your teaching, I feel that a lot of people in my generation are very apathetic mm-hmm. about truth and freedom and the pursuit of freedom and truth. How do you incite someone who is determined not to care to start pursuing these ideal goals and truths about our existence?
Well, there's two ways, and one is good for us to do, and one is not. God does both, positive and negative. What God does to get people who are boring and bored and self-satisfied and lazy to get up off their keister is he gives them a few kicks. He puts pain in their lives. And there's nothing that gets us more attention than that. We can't do that. We don't have that divine wisdom. It's arrogant for me to say to you, I think you're kind of stupid. I'm going to give you some pain to make you smart. But God does that. We do the opposite. We give them joy. Nobody ever refuted Mother Teresa. Here's a woman who had the longest dark night of the soul in human history, and she was one of the happiest people ever. Cheer. Real, honest joy. I often tell my agnostic students who don't believe all this stuff, I say, go hang out with the missionaries of charity for a few hours, and you will see what difference it makes. You will see joy. You will feel joy that you never felt before. And you can't argue with that. Now, in order to be a successful evangelist in that way, you have to have the joy that comes only from being a saint. So be a saint and help convert the world. That's all. It happened once. The hard-nosed Roman Empire converted because it saw Christians. What's wrong with these people? They're walking into the lion's mouth, smiling and singing hymns and forgiving their enemies. And when we do that, even in little ways, we'll get people's attention, even bored people. Because the human heart was designed for that. It was not designed at Harvard, it was designed in heaven.
What about Protestantism?
What about Protestants? Well, we thank God for them. We need a kick in the pants now and then. We certainly did 500 years ago. And if there hadn't been a Luther, there wouldn't have been a Council of Trent. And we can invite them home, but until we show them the joy of sanctity, until we show them that Catholics are better evangelicals than evangelicals are, they're not going to come home. And when we do, they will. And they are our separated brothers and sisters, and we love them, and they love Jesus Christ, sometimes put us to shame by how much they love Jesus Christ. And we can learn a lot from them, and they can learn a lot from us. So we have to do a lot more talking together. And both sides know for sure that the will of our common Lord is unity. Read John 17, Christ's high priestly prayer just before his passion. That's one of the most passionate prayers he ever prayed. To see his family squabbling, to see his body torn. That's not just a scandal to the world and an obstacle to evangelization. That's making our Lord very, very unhappy. So we've got to do something about it. John Paul II said in the most ecumenical encyclical any pope ever wrote, Ut Unum Sint, which means that they may be one, ecumenism is not an addition to the gospel, it's a necessary part of the gospel. Just like the social gospel is not an addition or another gospel, it's a necessary part. And working for reunion means at least two things, the two absolutes in every sphere of life. The two things no Christian can ever compromise on is truth and love. You don't find unity by compromising truth. Truth is an absolute. You don't find unity by condemning other people and failing to love them. Love is an absolute. How to get those two things together? There's no magic formula. But what's absolutely important is that you must have absolute passion for both.
Scandal is out of fashion. How do you recognize it? What do you do?
Well, in one sense, scandals have become extremely fashionable, but the concept of scandal, the proper understanding of the concept of scandal, is very rare. Most people think a scandal is simply some spectacular evil which is made interesting, usually by the media. But the proper meaning of scandal means leading somebody else into sin. And this is such a serious sin that Jesus Christ described these sinners in this way. One who causes these little ones of mine to sin, it would be good for him if a millstone were hanged around his neck and he were drowned in the depths of the sea. So scandal is a very, very serious sin, to lead someone else in the opposite direction from God. That's what scandal means. So there are many forms of scandal, not just the scandalous forms. Next question. I don't want to talk more than I need to about nasty things. And maybe I need to talk more about that, but I can't think of anything more about that now, so let's just say, don't do it. In other words, even if you're not too hot on climbing Jacob's ladder yourself, don't pull anybody else down who's climbing it.
In your book, Prayer for Beginners, you said something about a theologian that chose the debate rather than to go to heaven. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, that's a joke from C.S. Lewis. Theologian dies, is met at the gate of heaven by God, and he's given the choice of entering heaven or entering a theology lecture on heaven. He chose the lecture. Don't do it.
I have a couple personal questions. First, I'm wondering if you have a favorite saint and who that is. And
Augustine.
And why?
He's totally human, and he's the unique combination of a very brilliant head and a very passionate heart.
Have you ever experienced metanoia in your life?
Have I ever experienced what in my life?
Metanoia, personal conversion.
Personal conversion.
Yes.
Many, many times. Conversion simply means turning around. And every single time I put God at my back and run away from him, I have to be converted and turn around. If you mean, did I ever become an atheist? No. If you mean, did I ever have serious doubts? Yes, as a teenager. A lot of teenagers do. I think my doubt was more in the realm of, is this interesting? Is the faith beautiful? Yeah, it's probably true. I'm not smart enough to say it isn't. And it's obviously good. I mean, saints are good. But it doesn't turn me on somehow. Church services bore me. I hope heaven is not an eternal church service. If so, I don't want to go there. That's typical for teenagers, I think. We all have to go through that.
You've authored many books. Do you have a personal favorite?
Well, I put more blood, sweat, tears, and time into my novel, An Ocean Full of Angels, than anything else. It's probably not a very good novel, though, because only a few people bought it. But those who bought it say one of two things. I love this novel, every part of it. I didn't get it. What are you getting at? You either get it or you don't. I think my best books are the ones where I let other people do most of the talking, like my Summa of the Summa, which is an anthology with a lot of footnotes of Thomas Aquinas, and Christianity for Modern Pagans, which is Pascal's Pensées with a lot of explanations. When I piggyback on a great thinker, I'm a lot smarter than when I don't, because when a dwarf stands on the shoulders of a giant, he can see much farther ahead. I also recently wrote a book on Augustine's Confessions called I Burn for Your Peace, which I think is pretty good.
Will you be writing another novel? Do you have any plans?
No. I don't have enough blood left.